This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Russia's Phobos Grunt spacecraft crashed into the Pacific Ocean on Sunday. It was a failed mission. It was meant to travel to the Martian moon Phobos and bring back a soil sample, but it got stuck in Earth orbit instead, never made it out of there. But in lieu of shooting off another expensive sample return mission to Mars, there is a cheaper way. Just wait for those Mars rocks to come to us. It happens once about every 50 years, and we got lucky last July when a meteor shower spit some Martian samples right here down to Earth. They fell way out on the Moroccan desert, but the samples have come back. Since then, scientists, including my next guest, have been snatching up those meteorites from meteorite dealers. Yeah, they exist. What do you do once you get your hands on them? Can you even touch one without contaminating it? Is there any hope those chunks might contain some trace of organic compounds or even traces of past or present life? Joining me now to talk about it is Chris Hurd. He's associate professor and meteorite expert at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Hurd.
Thanks very much.
You are actually in actual possession of one of these chunks?
Yes. I arranged to purchase a specimen of this amazing meteorite for the University of Alberta Meteorite Collection.
How do you buy one of these?
Well, you talk to a meteorite dealer, and you work out a good value, good rate, and then you come up with some money.
I'm picturing this scene from Casablanca in that marketplace where people are selling all kinds of stuff. Is there an underground meteorite market with folks who come in out of the desert picking this stuff up?
Well, in actual fact, in Morocco, there's a whole economy set up with people picking up meteorites from the desert. They know what they look like, and they bring them into the markets and sell them there.
What do they look like? What does the one that you have look like?
Well, it's kind of unusual as meteorites go because it is a rarer type, being from Mars. But it has a black, what's called a fusion crust, the outer crust that formed as it came screaming through the atmosphere, that sort of burnt look to it. And then on one side, it's broken, and you can see a bit of the interior. The interior is sort of a greenish-gray color.
So it's sort of glass encrusted in its own little delivery vehicle.
Yeah, that's right. The outside heats up enough to actually melt the rock, and then that forms a glass as it cools off after it comes into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. And how do you analyze it without contaminating it? Now, because I'm figuring you're handling it. But you're saying since it's sort of covered in glass, it's the inside is sort of kept pristine from the way
it was.
Yeah,
well, that's something that we definitely want to test. How do you keep it from getting contaminated? That's probably one of the best questions, because this is a really incredible opportunity, being such a recent delivery, such a recent fall, that we want to try to do everything that we can to keep it from getting contaminated, including with organic molecules. And we have those on our fingers all the time, mm-hmm. and it's... It's just the way we are. We have things like cholesterol and squalene, weird sounding compounds like that actually are in our finger grease. And so one of the things that I did after we received this sample was to actually just give a little bit of a rinse on the outside with a solvent that we're going to analyze that hopefully later this week or next week and see what we find. It's actually kind of a way of detecting whether anybody's touched it before it got sent to me.
And then how do you crack it open and look inside?
Well, then we're going to do everything we can before. There's a lot of sort of non-destructive, as you call it, tests that we can do first. But then once we're ready, we'll cut it open. We'll use a very thin blade saw, and we'll cut it open, and we'll look inside, and we'll make polished mounts that we can do various types of analyses on with microscopes. And just try to get as much information as we can out of it.
How old is it, and does it come from a period on Mars where life might have existed?
That we don't know at this point. All we can say is that based on the original work that was done by my colleagues, Tony Irving and Scott Keener at University of Washington, Seattle, we know that it has a texture. That is, the minerals, the way they're intergrown, is very similar to other types of Martian meteorites that we've looked at before. But we don't know anything about the age yet. Having said that, those other meteorites that this is similar to are in the sort of 200 to 500 million year old range. That's geologically fairly young, and that's not from a time period that that where we think there was a lot of water around on Mars, but you never know.
Yeah, you know, there was that famous meteorite from Mars that supposedly had signs of ancient life on it that created a lot of excitement and then went away very quickly.
That's right, and that one was is around 4 billion years old. So that dates really from way back in Mars's history. As I say, we don't really know, because we only just started working on this, how old this particular meteorite is. But the potential is there because it's a fresh meteorite fall. Because it's been kept pretty clean as far as we know, that once we get into the inside of it, we may be able to find, what we find inside is more likely to be from Mars than from the Earth.
Let's go to the phones. Dale in Denver. Hi, Dale.
Yes. I'd just like to make the comment that, I mean, ever since I first heard of these meteorites that supposedly come from Mars being found on Earth, I've been incredibly skeptical. The odds of an asteroid, a large meteorite slamming into Mars and knocking debris up, and then having that stuff make it all the way to Earth are incredibly astronomical. Until we can actually get something from Mars and compare it to these meteorites, I think it's a little far-fetched making the claim that we're actually examining bits of Mars.
Right,
we have no proof of that.
Well, let me get a reaction, Dale. Thanks for that comment.
Sure, I can definitely address that. I mean, there was a really seminal series of studies that were done in the early 1980s on a particular Martian meteorite, a particular meteorite that belonged to this group that was found in the Antarctic. Prior to the mid-1970s, early 80s, these meteorites were kind of lumped into a group on their own. We didn't really know where they came from. We just knew that they looked different from other meteorites. In 1976, we had the Viking landers, and the Viking landers had instruments on board that could measure the composition of the Martian atmosphere. And they did that quite well. And in the early 1980s, this one meteorite was investigated and found to contain trapped gas inside of it. When that gas was analyzed, it was shown to be a match to what the Viking landers found in the Martian atmosphere. And further to that, it's been shown that the Martian atmosphere composition is unique in the solar system. There's no other planet or object or moon that has quite the same composition of atmosphere. So finding this trapped gas in the meteorite is a fingerprint that tells us that it comes from Mars.
Well, what can you learn from this meteorite or other meteorites that land in Morocco or other places, apart from what you can learn from the Antarctic ones that have already been discovered for many years?
Well, each one, they're all quite similar in some ways. They're all igneous rocks, that is, rocks that started their lives as a magma somewhere in the interior of Mars and came up and erupted near the surface. But they all have slight differences to them, and some of them are quite subtle. Some of them are even, more subtle than what you see just by slicing it open and looking at the texture. And so these are the types of advanced studies that we do to try to figure out what this new meteorite can tell us that we haven't found in other ones. Every single one tells us another piece of the puzzle of Mars geology as a whole. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we can do is to actually peer back through the magma crystallizing into this rock. We can peer back and say something about the magma itself and the interior of Mars, that part of Mars that it came from. So in some ways, we can almost probe right into the inside of Mars through these kinds of studies.
Mm. Now, Dale from Colorado was very skeptical about how could a meteorite, a piece of Mars, get here?
Well, he was right the ideas that some large object, some other meteorite, slammed into Mars and launched rocks off the surface. Mars is a smaller planet than the Earth. It has lower gravity, about one-third the gravity of the Earth. And it's been shown through modeling now that you can actually launch rocks off the surface of Mars. You don't even need a very large object hitting Mars in order to do it. The object that the minimum that you need is something that would hit Mars and make a crater about 3 kilometers across, which, sounds kind of large, but there's lots of craters that size or larger on Mars. You can get a rock sitting near the surface, accelerated, fast enough to leave Mars gravity.
And they could be floating around in the solar system for thousands of years, Till it
thousands or millions.
Or millions, until something happens to nudge it in this direction or it gets here?
It just happens to cross our orbit. And in fact, you know, the point about this is that because we keep getting this is now the fifth fall of a Martian meteorite, plus we found a whole bunch of other ones, some other meteorites all over the world that have fallen in, you know, prehistoric times. We know that there's debris out there, Martian debris, sort of floating around the solar system, and it keeps landing on us.
So there could be a lot more stuff out there in the desert.
Almost certainly, yes.
And are you going to be looking for more, or people? Is there competition to own this?
I'm sure there is. There's always competition. I'm sure there are groups out there looking right now. You know, the economy that exists around these things really drives people to, of course, go and look for more all the time.
What did you pay for this, if I might ask?
We paid $300 per gram.
And how many grams do you have?
58.
I'm doing a quick 60 times 300 is $18,000,
something like that.
Sounds pretty cheap to me for something that comes
on
from
the
Mars.
Low end. Huh? I have to say it's on the low end of what Martian and lunar meteorites tend to go for. They tend to be several hundred dollars per gram on up.
And so when can we see this? Will it be on exhibit or can we learn
more? There are a number of if any of your listeners get up to Edmonton in the next few years, we hope to have part of our piece that we purchased on display. But there are other groups making efforts to other collections, meteorite collections, purchasing other pieces, and the ones that are I know for sure Arizona State and New Mexico. So hopefully they have plans to show some specimens as well.
We have some photos on our website of this meteorite and other. We'll wait for other raiders of the lost meteorites.
Yeah. Right.
Do you feel like Indiana Jones sometimes?
Sometimes.
Well, thank you very much. And we'll wait to see the publication of what you found there.
It's just the beginning right now.
All right. Chris Hurd is associate professor and meteorite expert at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Thank you for joining us today.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.
The National Football League playoffs are down to four teams, and after the weekend, they will be down to two. On Sunday, the New England Patriots host the Baltimore Ravens, and the San Francisco 49ers host the New York Giants. The winners advance to the Super Bowl on February 5th. Sports writer Stefan Fatsis now joins us, as he does most Fridays. How you doing, Stefan?
Hey, Robert.
All season long, we've heard about how this season confirmed the total transformation of the NFL into a league dictated by offense. Suddenly, that is not looking like it's the correct conclusion.
Yeah, we're supposed to still be talking about the explosive, pass-happy Green Bay Packers and New Orleans Saints, but they were eliminated last weekend. So now three of the final four are defined by defense. The website Football Outsiders rates the 49ers and Ravens the third and fourth best defenses in the NFL for the season so far. And over the last month, it says that the Giants have had the best defense, and they all do different things well. The 49ers are great against the running game, and their punter, Andy Lee, is like a defender. He had one of the best seasons in NFL history, averaging 50.9 yards per punt. The Giants sack quarterbacks for big losses. The Ravens are very stout, especially against the pass in the so-called red zone. And that's when the other team gets within 20 yards of scoring.
And that should be awfully important on Sunday because Baltimore is playing the one team you haven't mentioned, the New England Patriots.
And I didn't mention them because the Patriots don't have a very good defense. They rely on their star quarterback, Tom Brady. The defense is one of the worst in the league. Brady threw for more than 5,000 yards in the regular season. He threw six touchdown passes against what was supposed to be a strong Denver Broncos defense last Sunday. He's in his sixth American Conference championship game in 12 seasons in the league. He's got the most diverse core of receivers in football, especially his two big tight ends, Aaron Hernandez and Rob Gronkowski. The Patriots haven't lost a game since November 6th. And love him or hate him, they've got Bill Belichick, the mastermind coach, looking for his fourth Super Bowl title.
Now, football wouldn't be football without a little trash talk, and we've had some of that leading up to this weekend, notably between the Giants and the 49ers.
And when you have good defenses, they take pride in the fact that they are aggressive and hard-hitting. And one Giants defensive lineman said that this game would be a bloodbath. The New York Post, of course, took that and put it on the back page with red ink dripping from the letters. And then the Giants running back, Brandon Jacobs, said all kinds of silly things. The most silly of which was, "I wish like hell they'd hit me in the head, a helmet-to-helmet hit. I want one of those." given the attention to concussions and helmet-to-helmet hits, and the latest in a string of lawsuits filed by retired players over concussions and brain disease came down this week against the league. So this was probably not a choice of words that NFL executives were thrilled with.
Now, some sillier pro football news involves the future of Indianapolis quarterback Peyton Manning. Tell us what happened there this week.
Manning, of course, missed the season with a neck injury. The Colts owe him $28 million in bonuses. So the question is whether they're going to pay it, let Manning leave, trade him, do something else. Then on Wednesday, we had this breaking news on Twitter. Hearing my fave, number 18 Peyton Manning will not return to NFL. Wow. The source of that tweet was the actor Rob Lowe. So his tweet sent reporters scrambling. Manning's father and his agent said that Manning's retirement was news to them. And Irsay finally responded with a tweet of his own. My sources tell me Rob will star in an epic remake of Deep Throat with aging porn stars and four-finger circus clowns.
Thank you, Stefan.
Let it not be said that NFL owners don't have a sense of humor, at least Jim Irsay.
And go Giants. Stefan Fatsis talks with us most Fridays about sports, and you can hear more of him on Slate Magazine's Sport Podcast. Hang up and listen.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. 2011 was the ninth warmest year on records, according to a new NASA report, and those records stretch back into the 1880s. And 9 of the 10 warmest years have happened since the year 2000. In other words, it's hotter than ever in modern history, but no data is enough to convince some climate change deniers about global warming. Lawmakers in several states have already introduced laws to make sure the views of climate skeptics are represented in the classroom. Louisiana has already passed one. And as the case with teaching evolution, rather than deal with complaints of parents, some teachers are just avoiding teaching climate change altogether, saying it's more trouble than it's worth. That's where my next guest comes in. Her group, the National Center for Science Education, has defended evolution teaching for decades, and now it's taking on this new challenge to keep good climate science in the classroom and bad science out. Let me introduce her. Eugenia Scott is the Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education in Oakland. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you very much, Ira. It's great to be back.
How widespread is this phenomenon?
We have noticed, of course, every year, as you and I have discussed, there have been a batch of anti-evolution bills submitted to state legislatures. But over the years, we've noticed that many times these anti-evolution bills also bundle global warming along with evolution as allegedly controversial issues that teachers are supposed to give balance to. And we know what that means. You're supposed to teach standard science and then teach anti-science or anti that particular view. In fact, one was just introduced, we don't even have it up on our website yet, one was just introduced yesterday in Oklahoma that would do this. Mm-hmm. But we're also hearing reports of school boards and local school districts discussing regulations or imposing some sort of restrictions on teachers to teach climate change and climate change denial, basically. And that's obviously something that has a chilling effect. But I think the thing that really motivated us to get into this is the stories that we're hearing from individual teachers more and more frequently, that they are receiving pushback from either students or from parents and, of course, the board of directors that pays their salary in the local school district. And we thought that maybe our experience in dealing with these, really, they're political issues, not really scientific issues so much, on the local level might help teachers cope with these pressures, just as we've attempted to help them over the years cope with pressures against teaching evolution. So, yeah, it's out there, Ira, and it's a problem that we'd like to get ahead of. You know, sometimes I think that the climate change climate change education issue is sort of where evolution was 25 years ago or 25, 30 years ago. And it took us a while to gear up, us being, you know, NCSC, but the science community as well. Maybe we can get ahead of this one and it won't be quite as big a problem.
Right, but evolution was based originally as a religious point of view. You're saying that this is more a political point of view.
That's correct. The commonality is that with the anti-evolution problem that we've been dealing with, yes, you're right, the ideology that motivates it is religious ideology. There's some religious ideology that motivates the anti-global warming group, but it's not really predominant. I mean, there's, you know, God's providence would never let anything bad happen to the Earth is out there, but that's not really what's motivating and paying for the surge of anti-global warming and climate change that we've seen recently. It's more a political ideology and or an economic ideology. It's the idea that if the planet's getting warming, if the planet is truly getting warmer, then we're going to have to do something about this, and this is going to require us to make compromises, perhaps in our standard of living. I might lose my job if I'm in a business that's an occupation that has to do with energy production based on carbon, you know, coal, oil, gas, etc. People really have sincere fears about what's going to happen, and clearly the easiest thing to do is just attack the science. You know, well, the science is invalid. It's not really getting warmer. This is just an effort by liberals to increase big government. You hear that kind of argument out there as well. And so, you know, yes, the science is necessary. You know, yes, we will have to deal with the claim it's just sunspots, or it's just the sun, or it's just normal cyclical kinds of things. It's volcanoes, not human putting CO2 in the air. We're going to have to deal with that. But fundamentally, we're going to have to deal with this, these underlying issues. Just like with evolution, you have to deal with the underlying religious issue and try to assuage some of those concerns. Because, you can't solve this problem by just piling more science on it.
And science teachers are avoiding the whole thing altogether.
We have reason to believe, but it's only anecdotal. There hasn't been a really good survey, a good, reliable, you know, standard survey research method type of survey of teachers as to what they know about climate change, climate science, and what they're actually teaching about it. But we have reason to believe anecdotally that many teachers are saying, whoa, this is another controversial issue. I'll just, it's too much work to, you know, I don't want to put up with the crap. I'm just not going to teach it.
We have a lot of people who email us or blog us and say, if I want to answer climate change skeptics, where do I get information? What kind of hard data can I tell them that why I'm convinced of it?
I think a website that I have found very useful and that I recommend to people, and we'll certainly link to it from the resources on NCSE's website, is skepticalscience.com. It's a very useful site. It's written by scientists and knowledgeable people, engineers and the rest. And they have very clear explanations with links, you know, documented scientific research supporting their views for the top 100 or so climate change denialist arguments. So if you want to know whether sunspots are the cause of the global warming, well, they'll explain that very clearly to you, and they actually have, for most of their refutations, they have more than one level. So, you know, here's the basic level and here's the more advanced level, and you click on the more advanced level and you get the 8x10 glossies and a lot more detailed than probably most people actually need. But it's a very useful site. Mm-hmm. And there are other sites also. The Smog Blog is another one that refutes many of the arguments. So the refutations are out there. Mm-hmm. It's not going. And NCSE is not going to have a lot of that information on our site. We'll have some of it, just, you know, basic stuff. But we will link. We will provide links to good scientific responses to the claims of the global warming deniers.
Well, Dr. Scott, thank you, Eugenie, for coming on and talk with us.
More than happy to. Thanks so much for helping us get out the word that we're here to help on this topic as well as evolution.
Dr. Eugenie Scott is the Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education that's based in Oakland, California.
This tough economy has not been good for home values in a lot of areas. At least the thinking goes that means saving money on your property taxes. Not so. Millions of homeowners are actually seeing their property taxes either hold steady or climb, even as their house may be worth much less. As Brian Bull of member station WCPN in Cleveland explains, there might not be much homeowners can do about it.
I won't say how much my home value has fallen in recent years, but at least I'm not alone in asking, what's up with my property taxes? Turns out that the economic downturn, state laws, and appraisals have created some nasty surprises. Cuyahoga County's fiscal officer, Wade Steen, has been taking lots of calls from unhappy homeowners lately. He says they most often live in a community where voters passed a recent levy. That's a property tax measure that boosts funding for things like schools and libraries.
Shaker Heights comes to mind, where the voters have voted for those school levies, which is going to naturally raise the taxes that they pay.
With about $3,700 paid per $100,000 of home value, the Cleveland area community of Shaker Heights has the highest property tax rates in Ohio. Voters here approved major school levies in 2006 and 2010. Maybe some residents grumble, but most enjoy what levies provide, like Myra White, who's lived in Shaker since 1964.
We have garbage pickup in our backyard. If they miss my house and I call, they'll make a special run on another day. On Halloween, there are fire trucks and police cars driving around. I guess that's just kind of for fun, but it's also like a patrolling thing. It's almost, oh gosh, I hate to say this, but it's a little bit of a concierge environment.
Levies are often the only recourse school districts and other agencies have for increased funding. Kevin O'Brien of the Great Lakes Environmental Finance Center says that's because the recession forced states to slash budgets, sending less money to counties and municipalities.
And this hurts communities, not having the revenue that they anticipated from the prior years and having to carry the same number of staff and the same body of services, so they have to find creative ways to cover the gap.
Another reason for your property taxes not seesawing with your home value could be state law. Back in the 1970s and 80s, many legislatures passed bills designed to keep property tax collections from automatically going up with inflation. Again, Wade Steen.
Voters fail to remember that through the 80s, when property values were going up astronomically, their tax bills were holding fairly steady, maybe increasing modestly. But yet we never heard anyone say, geez, my property value has doubled in 5 years. This is great, but my taxes aren't doubling.
But the flip side to these laws, found in nearly 40 states, is that when home values plummet, the assessment rate can increase to keep revenues at that fixed rate. And that's what's happening today. You might also take your government to task if they don't do annual assessments. Jacqueline Byers heads research for the National Association of Counties.
I live in Virginia, and they reassess property every year. But right across the river in Maryland, they are in a three-year assessment cycle. So what can really happen to them is that their property taxes will be high, even in a down economy, because they're using data for the value of their property that's 2 to 3 years old.
In other words, the assessment's based on years when home values were higher and not reflecting current value. So what can you do? In most cases, you can challenge your assessment if you feel it's not accurate and can back up that claim. Ohio's Cuyahoga County projects 26,000 property valuation complaints this year, almost twice the number from 2011. For NPR News, I'm Brian Bull in Cleveland.
South Carolina isn't just known for picking winners. It's been called the firewall for its ability to halt candidates on a roll. And there is, of course, a lot at stake for the candidates who are looking to push Mitt Romney off the path to the nomination. Here to talk more about it are regular Friday political commentators David Brooks of the New York Times and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post. Gentlemen, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
So let's briefly start with Rick Perry. It seems like every election season there's sort of a super hyped candidate who doesn't quite catch. And this time it was him. We said goodbye to him this week. Does his exit even matter?
Well, his exit will matter in South Carolina, not only because whatever pieces of the conservative vote he was getting are now free to go presumably to Newt Gingrich. All his ads that he was running against Gingrich and Santorum are now off the air. That also helps Gingrich. I think he, on paper, he's the guy we should be talking about as a nominee. He occupied the perfect place in the Republican Party to unite the Tea Party elements and the religious right. But there were times when he seemed intent on making President Bush looked like a combination of Albert Einstein and Hubert Humphrey. I mean, he couldn't get his act together in those early debates,
David,
and he was very conservative.
Any parting words for Perry?
Yeah, my 12-year-old son asked for his autograph, and he wrote, "Do your homework." And I wish Rick Perry had done his homework.
Exactly,
it's a lesson against coming in late. It helps to come in early when nobody's paying attention so you can practice your routines.
Another thing that was talked about a lot this week was wealth among the GOP candidates. Mitt Romney, of course, has been the standout. Talk about his tax return, the tax rate, and everything. But is this really a conversation about how much money these guys have or whether they can identify with, like, blue-collar voters?
Right. I think it's a question of personality. It is in the fall, both Obama and Romney, assuming they both get there, want to talk about success and their different versions of it. My view of Romney is very different from most people. Most people look at the guy's face and think he's the bad guy in an F. Scott Fitzgerald novel. I look at his family history, which is really a story of struggle, of his family moving from Illinois to Utah to Arizona to Mexico to California, constantly being knocked down, constantly struggling. And I look at him less as sort of a WASP scion and more as a relentlessly driven immigrant kid. And his experience is not sort of the George H.W. Bush experience. So to me, what's remarkable about him is not his wealth, but his ferocious and relentless drive and the desire to be accepted in America.
David may be entirely right about that family history, but I can't recall any candidate more awkward in talking about issues related to his personal wealth and making gaffes like saying he didn't get much money from speeches, and it turned out it was $350,000, $370,000, and just not getting people's reactions when he says these things. And so I think a lot of these were self-inflicted wounds, and then he has just been terrible on this issue of releasing his taxes. A campaign ought to figure out where it wants to be on that, have a position, and stick with it. And he has really hurt himself just on the issue of releasing his income taxes.
And, of course, David, some of that personal backstory goes into some Mormon history in Romney's family that maybe he doesn't want to talk about on the
trail. It's a disadvantage for his campaign that he can't talk about his backstory because of the Mormonism. I'd love to have sat in the meeting when his staff said to him, "Hey, what are you going to say about your tax reform?" I suspect he told them, "Hey, I've got it under control," because it's a subject he didn't want to talk about even with them, and they didn't want to press him about it. But it's their job to press him and get a script.
One of the bombshell of the week involves something that I know I didn't expect to talk about this season, open marriage. Discuss. Marian Gingrich talking about her ex-husband. What happened here?
Very ugly marriage. I think former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford is thinking, what did I resign for? Apparently my voters like this because it has not hurt him at all. He was having an affair while he was attacking Bill Clinton for having an affair with somebody on his staff. I think it's a perfectly legitimate character issue to talk about, but he used it in the debate to trounce the media, which is for a lot of Republicans the unifying emotion, the desire to trounce the media, and it's worked fabulously.
And let's go before we go further. We actually have a clip of that at the debate. Here is Gingrich talking with debate moderator John King, who has just asked this question about his ex-wife's comments.
I think the destructive, vicious, negative nature of much of the news media makes it harder to govern this country, harder to attract decent people to run for public office. And I am appalled that you would begin a presidential debate on a topic like that.
Guys, I mean, maybe the question was ill-timed, but I mean, it seems like Gingrich only can win off of these things.
Who knew that a candidate could turn open marriage into a winning issue in South Carolina? This campaign is constantly surprising us. But you knew that Gingrich was going to come out and try to blame this all on the media and attack on the media and attack the media because it's worked for him before. He's been running against the media in all of the debates. And, you know, some of his surge in South Carolina began when he attacked Juan Williams. And that attack, this one I sort of think of as normal politics. That one was very disturbing because there were racial overtones there. Juan Williams was challenging him directly on this. And there was a kind of almost, I thought, a little bit of an ugly kind of glee in the crowd in response to that. But in this case, he did what he had to do on the open marriage issue. And I think for now, he's pushed it aside.
And it's interesting because, I mean, basically Gingrich has put his personal redemption and his background out there. So I'm wondering, even if he gets a bump now, is this going to kind of have residual effects further down the trail with his history just hanging out there?
Right. It means we will have a long primary fight. I think right now we're guaranteed to go to Florida, probably go for another couple months. I still find it very hard to believe that a politician with a 27% national approval rating is going to get the nomination. So it'll prolong it. It's still hard to see how Romney loses this thing, unless there's something hidden in those tax returns.
Well, we'll know in the next day or so whether or not this race continues for the next few weeks. David Brooks of The New York Times and E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post, thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Carol Channing, who created iconic roles on Broadway in Hello, Dolly! And Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, isn't touring quite as much as she once did. But in the words of a song she sang more than 5,000 times, she's still going strong. At least that's the impression critic Bob Mondello got from the new documentary, Carol Channing, Larger Than Life.
I'm just a little girl from Little Rock.
Whenever New York Times caricaturist Al Hirschfeld sketched Carol Channing, he always made her appear a creature composed entirely of lipstick, mascara, and hairspray. It says something about both his artistry and hers that Channing has generally come across that way in real life, too, as a fabulous but insubstantial cartoon. Channing was one of the few stars who could live up to those drawings, and as if to prove that, Dori Berenstein's documentary animates a couple and sets them right next to the star, who's pretty animated too, considering her advanced years.
77, it doesn't make any difference. And here I am almost 90, and I'm still doing shows. I don't know why you applaud that, it just happens.
Channing is definitely performing Carol Channing for the camera, but she's pretty canny about the impression she's making. She's shown being a tireless trooper, practically taking TV interviewers hostage. In one clip, she reduces Jean Shalit to helpless cackling. Elsewhere, the film shows her playing gamely off her stage roles in a montage of sitcom appearances.
Hello, Deli.
Hello, Andy.
Hello, Gomer.
Why, Miss Carol.
Hello, Dolly.
Hello, Dolly.
Though she never clicked in the movie, she does recount a film memory or two of her first on-screen smooch, for instance, with a kid named Clint Eastwood. But Carol Channing, Larger Than Life, mostly concentrates on career highlights and personal moments. A happy reunion after 7 decades with a childhood sweetheart gets lots of time, as does nostalgia for a brand of entertaining practiced by very few stars these days. I'm Bob Mondello.
Oh, you remember. Thank you, you lovely people.